Hi there, and welcome back to Hugo's There 2.0 for another zoomed out author deep dive episode. And this time it's Ian M. Banks, and my guest is Damian McQuillan. Sorry, I think I butchered that a little bit.
No, that's fine. That's perfect. Yeah. But you can call me Damo.
So hi there, Damo. Yeah, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, how are you?
Good. So tell me a little bit about yourself. What's your history as a science fiction fan?
Yeah, so anticipating that you might ask me that, I was thinking back on, you know, some of your guests and how they answer, and they seem to fall into two categories. There's usually people who can remember that first book they read when they were 15, you know, when they were 25 or 35 or whatever. But I have no such anecdotes. I cannot remember a time when I was reading, when I was not reading science fiction. You know, I have always read it. When I was a teenager, Dublin used to be, in the 1980s, falling down with loads of these secondhand bookshops, which were full of cheap paperbacks, you know, all the covers and all that stuff. Both from the US, but mostly from Britain. And I just bought them by the sack load, you know, and devoured my way through them, you know. Yeah, I think one of the themes I hear a lot in people's recollections of their science fiction history is how much you read when you were a teenager, you know, and I was no exception, you know. So that's really it. I just don't remember a time. Now, I will say I read a huge amount as a teenager, as I said, but once I came to my 20s and 30s, you know, tedious things like work and life and stuff get in the way, you know, so my consumption dropped a good bit, you know. But that's really, you know, I'm science fiction to the bone. I think that might be the best way to put it.
So we're going to talk about Ian M. Banks, also known as Ian Banks, depending on what kind of fiction he's publishing.
Yeah.
So why don't you give us an introduction, and, you know, why an Irishman wanting to talk about a Scottish author?
Yeah, now I will make one comment on that, and you can back me up on this. I did explicitly say that if a Scottish person came along and wanted to do an author zoom out on Ian Banks, that I would magnanimously step aside. Why do I want to talk about him? I mean, so one of my roles in science fiction, I actually have one these days. I'm in the Facebook Science Fiction Book Club, Facebook group, and I'm a moderator now. And it has quite struck me over the last few years I've been doing that when we ask people to name their favorite authors, and partly just to make sure they're not rooting bots or anything like that, but also just to get a sense that they know this is a written science fiction group and you know, we know them and so on. So when you look at the list of names that get mentioned, you could draw up a list of about, I'd say, 5 or 6, maybe 10, maybe a dozen, that, you know, 99% of our applicants would include, you know, the usual Clark, Asimov, Bradbury, or whatever. And Banks would be one of those dozen. He comes up a lot. He's very much a favorite of, I would say, at least 10, if not 20% of our members anyway. You know, he comes up over and over again for particularly his storytelling and particularly the ideas that he conveys in his novels, you know, the for want of a better word, the philosophical ideas he puts forward. And particularly the subset of his work involving the culture, which, you know, we'll be talking about that. A lot of people just, when they're asked, what are your favorite novels? They'll just say the culture series, you know, which is, you know, a good few books, you know, to say the least. So he comes up all the time, you know, and he's, you know, he's one of the major figures in, he's one of the major figures in science fiction in general. He has a particular role, though, in that he was one, and I think he might be the first one, you could say, of a group of mostly British science fiction writers like Paul Macaulay and Alistair Reynolds and a few others who essentially reinvented the idea of what science fiction could be, and in specifically space opera. They started writing these great tales of galactic, interstellar, intergalactic goings on and so forth. People can't see, but I'm waving my hands here to indicate the scale of things. And they, you know, space opera used to be a kind of, almost a joke at this, you know, during the 60s and 70s, you know, during the new wave and all this kind of thing, you know, so it was very hackneyed and old. People are thinking of the Lensman series and all that, and they're not particularly well written, it has to be said. That's personal opinion there. Whereas Banks and these other guys, they reinvented that, you know, and they brought a completely new sensibility to it and used it for quite different purposes across the board, but very much changed the way it was written and made it a much more serious or a subgenre to be taken seriously as well. Now, there's quite a variety in there. Some of them, like Reynolds in particular, are very hard science fiction as well as space opera. Mm-hmm. Hanks, not so much, but that's his significance. You know what I mean? He's a hugely significant figure. An Irishman we'll be talking about him, I lived there for a few years and I found that having read his mainstream fiction before I moved there, I found that I recognized the place and I recognized the people. And then since I've lived there, you know, he's just been he's just one of my favorite writers anyway. So that's why I'm here talking about him.
Yeah. One of the hurdles with space opera is you do kind of have to decide, is this generation ship space opera or is it faster than light space opera? Because those are kind of the two ends of it, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, Reynolds is very much generation ships, stick to the laws of physics, you know, nothing faster than light, and makes mm-hmm. great use of that for dramatic effect and so on. Mm-hmm. Banks, no, I'm just going to invent some sort of hyperdrive and off we go, you know. So, some people would argue that Banks's science fiction is not really science fiction per se, like definitely not hard science fiction, you know.
Right.
It could be argued that it's almost fantasy in the kind of Star Wars, or maybe not Star Wars, maybe Star Trek, you know, in that kind of sense, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and we'll talk more about sort of the culture in particular and the kinds of technology and social constructs and that kind of stuff that verge on that. Okay, so that's just sort of an intro to Banks, right?
Yeah.
So anything in particular about the author do you want to talk about, you know, biographical kind of details?
Yeah, what I might do is I'll give a brief summary of his life, but what I might do then is, if you don't mind, I might actually talk about his politics as well. To get that out of the way fairly early on, because another thing about the importance of Banks is he is unequivocally what you might call a left-wing writer. He brings forward ideas that are, I'm not sure whether you'd call him this might sound like a silly thing, but I'm not sure if you'd call him an out-and-out socialist in a sort of rigorous sense. But one thing you can say about him is he is extremely anti-capitalist. I've written up all these kind of summary notes here about the various novels I'm going to be chatting about. And it's actually interesting for me reading back on his works to come and talk here that I've always would have casually said, yeah, you know, he's very critical of capitalist societies and imperialism and so on. But reading over this stuff, he really is. Like, it's not just a cliche or a truism. Like, it saturates his work. He entirely is using science fiction and indeed his mainstream stuff, and we'll talk about that distinction in a minute, to critique our kind of societies, capitalism and indeed authoritarian governments and feudal systems and monarchies and what have you, you know. So it's one of his defining features. And I'm going to say this early on because some of your listeners might be thinking, I might give that Banks guy a try. And, you know, he has certain political positions and opinions that would mean that they would just not enjoy him and would just switch off.
Sure.
He could be summarized as being, if you know the old classics, so to speak, and you're not familiar with more modern stuff, he could be summarized as being an anti-Heinlein. He uses science fiction in the same way to discuss ideological ideas and issues, but he's coming from, in almost every way, the opposite form or the opposite idea or the opposite analysis to Heinlein.
Yeah. You know?
To put my cards on the table, Heinlein is not a writer I particularly enjoy, including just simply for his writing ability, you know, but aside from all the other sleazy stuff that's in his book. I mean, that's not Heinlein. Let's stick with Banks. You can cut that out if you want.
We'll get somebody on eventually to talk about Heinlein we'll see how fair we can be.
Right. But anyway, yeah, so let me just summarize his life briefly and then I'll start talking about the politics. So I will say one thing about Banks as well before I get on to that. He is extremely Scottish in the sense that his wit and his way of talking and his ideas, and I'm saying this now, I'm just a person who reads science fiction. As you know, your regular guest or your friend, Ivor Watkins, whenever he's on a podcast, he just says, I'm just a bloke who likes science fiction, you know, and I say that about myself. I'm no scholar by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
But so I mean that in a kind of prosaic sense, but others, particularly the likes of Paul Kincaid, would say that in a literary analysis kind of way, like that there's a lot of themes in Scottish literature that Banks inherits, you know. So he's very Scottish in that sense. But there's a great interview with him on the BBC website. If you searched for just BBC 5-minute interview Ian Banks, you'll find it straight away. And the chap asks him, whoever's doing the interview asks him, should we be looking for two levels in your books, right? And straight away Banks says, only two. You know, he gives this mock kind of shock and horror and says you should be more ambitious, you know. But then he kind of turns that on his head and he says, you should look for as many as you want. This is a direct quote. I think you can look for as many as you want. They might even be there, you know. And it's such a self-effacing comment, but it's also such a witty comment, you know. And that kind of... Mm-hmm. That summarizes Banks. So he was born in Dunfermline, which, if you know Scotland at all, it's in Fife. And his father was in the Admiralty, so that means the sort of the British government arm that runs the navy. I think that's what that means. So you know, they live near the Rosyth Naval Dockyards, which very significantly is. And you know, I'm open to correction on this, but I'm pretty sure it's where the British nuclear deterrent, which is based around submarines, it was based there. Now that became very important for Banks later in his life. So they lived in a place called North Queensferry until he was about 9 years old, and then they moved to a place called Gourock, which is on the west coast of Scotland near Glasgow. So if you listen to Banks's voice, if you listen to him talking, no more than himself, he doesn't have a particularly strong Scottish accent. You know, it's that kind of product of moving around a bit. So, you know, he's kind of very clearly spoken, very easy to understand, you know, even though it's a beautiful accent, you know. And somebody, while he was living in Gourock, gave him a book, which I have never heard of and have never seen a copy of, called Kemlo and the Zones of Silence by a writer called E.C. Eliot. And I have never heard of that writer or seen that book or whatever. So that was his introduction to science fiction, and he never looked back. He went to the University of Stirling, and he was there until 1975. So he's kind of someone who was in college during the 70s, you know, what all that sort of implies. And quite significantly, he studied English and then philosophy and psychology. And while he was there, he would have come across the ideas. There's a Scottish psychologist called Artie Lang. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. It's probably Artie Lang or something like that. He wrote a book called The Divide Itself. And it's an interesting one because in a lot of Banks's work, as we'll see, there are characters who are unreliable narrators or who have split personalities of certain types. Now, usually based around technology or you know, ideas like that. But it's kind of reminiscent of Robert Louis Stevenson and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which of course is set in Edinburgh, and Stevenson was from Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of an echo there of, apparently a lot of Scottish literature has these kind of ideas in it, you know. So, you know, that's a significant part of his background, I think, that informed a lot of his writing. And then he did that usual thing that writers do where they get all these jobs that leave them time in the evenings to write. And then he, you know, moved around and he worked in London and he moved throughout Europe and North America and all that. So he was quite well traveled by the time he came to actually publish any of his works. He worked as something, I made a note of this myself, something in IBM called an expediter and analyzer, which I'm not quite sure what that is. I think it's some kind of clerk or something like that. But anyway, he worked for a legal firm at one point in London, and the novel Walking on Glass kind of reflects his experience of being a Scottish person there. So that's his life. Now, of course, the most significant and the saddest fact about Ian Banks is that he died in 2013, and he was in his early 50s. He was younger than I am now. So I'm in my mid-50s. So he announced on his website that he had pancreatic cancer, inoperable cancer. And he said he was told, I think his exact words were that he was very poorly and that he had only about a year to live, according to the doctors and so on who were treating him. But he didn't even last that long. He only lasted a few months after that. So he died on the 9th of June, 2013. And my own, on a personal note, my own first interaction with social media of any kind was leaving my condolences on his website, because his website was absolutely flooded with people some of whom had met him and were saying how what a lovely person he was, and apparently, you know, by all accounts, he was a very nice person. But there was loads of people just who had never met him, only knew him through his books, but just came in to say how much they meant to him and how much his books meant to them, and so on, and what they had learned from his work, and so on. So it was quite extraordinary. He actually, it's kind of a sad fact, but he actually didn't have enough time to read all the notices that were left on his website before he died. I think he only read a third of them or a quarter of them or something like that, you know, which is a reflection of how quickly he went, but also of the level of love there was for him, you know. So that's a kind of sad aspect to his role in science fiction. You know, there's a lot of sci-fi guys who lived a long time, and we've lost quite a few significant figures over the last few years. Mm-hmm. You know, but they're usually, you know, not that it's any less sad, but they're usually figures in their 70s, and Ursula Le Guin lived till her 90s. Mm-hmm. But he was only, I think it was 52 or 53, something along those lines anyway. So that's his life.
So he's, you know, like I mentioned sort of toward the top, right? He published under more than one name because he had science fiction and non-science fiction. And so I know you want to talk about sort of which work do we classify as science fiction?
Yeah. So that's a particularly important thing. I should make one point here now. Here's my advantage of having actually lived in Scotland. The M in the Ian M. Banks, it stands for the name Menzies, or should I say what looks like the name Menzies, but is actually pronounced Minnie's. There's a chain of shops. I'm not sure if they're even still there. And, you know, when I was living over there, I said, oh, yeah, I'm going down to that shop, Menzies. And all the Scottish people, of course, burst out laughing and said, no, you're Egypt, you're foreign Egypt. It's called Minnie's. So the M comes from the fact that his father apparently, this is the anecdote anyway, his father was apparently meant to call him Ian Minnie's Banks, after, I think it was an uncle or something like that. And the father somehow forgot to include the middle name or the second surname or whatever. So he was just registered as Ian Banks. And the family seemed to know him as Ian Minnie's Banks. So he originally published The Wasp Factory. That was his first book that was actually published. So his mainstream work was published as Ian Banks. And he tells this story that he regards as being slightly ludicrous, and I agree with him, that the publisher didn't want to call him Ian M. Banks because there's a writer in, I don't know if you're a fan of P.G. Wodehouse. My mother made me read all those. Well, when I say made, introduced me to P.G. Wodehouse when I was young.
Yeah.
And encouraged me to read them so I'd know why the Brits lost the empire, because of their degenerate and useless upper classes. and that was good advice. There's a fictional writer in the Jeeves and Wooster novels called Rosie M. Banks. So alleged, and she's a romantic novelist. She writes these dreadful sentimentalist awful books, you know, apparently. Mm. So apparently he would have been confused with her, but Banks thinks that's nonsense himself, you know. It's a bit of a silly.
I've only read a couple of the Jeeves books, but I didn't remember.
I can just about remember her. But anyway, so the uncles kept giving him a hard time about the fact that the M was gone from his name. So when he had his first science fiction novel, which was Consider Phlebas, he said, "Look, let's distinguish between my science fiction and my mainstream work." By using the M, you know, so and I think the publishers were quite on board with that, because I think they were showing that little bit of, what's the word I'm looking for here, that snobbery about science fiction, you know, it can't be treated as seriously as is regular literature, you know, this kind of crap. Sorry. you know, this kind of nonsensical distinction between them. And I might actually just comment on that distinction between his different types of work. If you read around about Banks, Paul Kincaid, I mentioned him earlier. I should say I'm talking about him because he wrote a particularly important life of Ian Banks. He would regard Banks's work as occupying a kind of spectrum. You know, there's stuff that's very traditional, sort of mainstream novels set in, usually in Scotland or usually in Britain, if not Scotland. That's very kind of, you know, mainstream literature, as it says, like the likes of Espadera Street or one of his more well-known mainstream works, which is The Crow Road. And then there's his science fiction, you know, and including the culture novels. But and I should also say that John Clute wrote an article on Banks in the Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, and he said pretty much the same thing. I think he actually used the word spectrum. I think I'm taking that from the Clute article. But, I mean, that's accurate, you know, that's very, you know, that is true, and it is, but it's not particularly, I'm going to put it, it's not particularly useful. Do you know what I mean? If you walk into a bookshop and you pick up a book by Banks, what are you going to get? What I would say is that there's kind of, there's three or three and a half categories of Banks. There's stuff that's mainstream, that's called Ian, that's written by Ian Banks. Stuff that's, it is mainstream, but has science fictional elements or fantastical elements in it. The likes of The Bridge or Walking on Glass. A lot of his earlier work, actually. And even The Wasp Factory, which is, you know, it is a straightforward mainstream novel, strictly speaking, but it is really weird. So using that word, I would follow China, how do you pronounce his name? China Mieville's, and he uses the phrase weird fiction.
Right.
Me, a lot of Banks is weird fiction, particularly a lot of his earlier work. And then the Ian M. Banks is outright science fiction. So that's okay. The one distinction you could make. If it's Ian M., it's going to be in space, you know? And well, maybe except for one or two novels. But and the bulk of his science fiction is culture. There's only about three or four that are science fiction, but not culture. So that's the way we would, you know, that's how I would view the sort of classification of his work.
Yeah.
Now, I might go back and talk about the politics side of it. So, as I said to you, he really was an out-and-out lefty. So, you know, he one of his best friends in Scotland, he actually met him in school, I think, was a chap called Ken MacLeod. Now, he's a, what you might call a doctrinaire communist, I think you could call him. But Banks is a little bit more, I won't say soft left. He's not a centrist by any means. You know, he's very, very definitely left of centre. But, you know, he is definitely a socialist. In Scotland, he used to vote for a party called, I don't know if you know anything about Scottish politics or history or anything like that, or British politics, but there's a Labour Party in Britain, which is, you know, one of the two main parties. Yeah. They're very much a kind of a practical socialist party, you know, links with trade unions and so on. And since Tony Blair, you wouldn't really regard them as being a socialist party at all. But Banks used to vote for a crowd called the Scottish Socialist Party. And they were, you know, they wanted to get rid of the monarchy. They wanted an independent Scotland, socialist Scotland. They were pro-European. They would have wanted the UK to stay within the EU and for Scotland to join the EU upon their independence. But they wanted the European Union to, I should say, in a science fiction context, when I say EU, I don't mean expanded universe. I mean European Union. He would have wanted, and that party would have wanted, the European Union not to be such a German-dominated neoliberal, you know, marketing, you know, not just a common market, you know.
Yeah.
So that was his kind of general politics. But one, you know, I should say he was very pro-independence and he was very proud of Scottish culture and life. And a lot of his work, you could argue, he would say that Scottish politics is a lot more communitarian than British politics in general. Something I think I agree with. I think that's probably true. So there's a strong kind of either mellow or even hard left vein in Scottish politics. So that was him. You know, he was part of that tradition and he was proud of that tradition as well. But one aspect of his politics that I should be open about, particularly, I don't know how much you want to go into modern politics here now, but anyway, yeah, I'll go on. He was a ferocious critic of Israel. He was part of the anti-apartheid movement against South Africa in the 1970s and the 1980s. And in particular, he saw how sanctions helped bring about the end of apartheid in South Africa. So he was a very early advocate of the BDS movement, Boycott, Divest, Sanction. I actually had a quote from him about Israel, but I'm not going to use it actually because it's very strident. You know, he just regarded them as a rogue state. And he thought that nothing short of BDS would bring about change. And he refused to allow any Israeli publisher to publish his work in the same way that I think if he had been published in the 70s, he would refuse to allow, for example, it to be translated into Afrikaans or published in South Africa, you know. And he took the same approach to Israel. Now, of course, a lot of people take him up on that. He was accused of being anti-Semitic in the same way Robert Fisk was. But he would say, well, look, I don't want my books published in Saudi Arabia either, you know, for exactly the same reason. And as part of that, you know, he was very critical of the whole Western imperialism, colonialism, call it what you want. He famously tore up his passport and posted it to, I think he posted it to 10 Downing Street, which is where the British Prime Minister lives, during the start of the war in Iraq, the 2003 Second War in Iraq. You know, so he's very much a critic of the West, you know, and totalitarianism anywhere. Like, so you're a critic of the Soviet Union as well, if that still existed, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's me being upfront completely about his politics. So, you know.
Does that fall under the shocking bits?
No.
In your outline?
No, there's a lot more to that. Yeah, actually, I might talk about his writing style first and then talk about the shocking bits. Yeah.
Okay,
so, the writing style of Banks is, I think it's another reason, in my opinion or my estimation, that he's very, very popular. Because when you read his work, I don't know how you found it now when you're reading his stuff, but to me, he seems very direct and a very, I'm going to say, simple writing style now, absolutely not simplistic by any stretch of the imagination. But he's also, as I said, when I say direct, what I mean by that is that he sets things out for you quite plainly and straightforwardly. Mm-hmm. And he's not sentimentalist in any way. You know, there will be a lot of sentiment in his work, but, you know, he's not in any way cloying or sentimental or anything like that. At the moment, I'm reading his book, Inversions. It's quite an interesting one in the sense that I said near the start that, you know, when you see Ian M. Banks, you're in space, but that's not the case with Inversions. It's a book that kind of reads almost like a history book. You know, you're reading about lives in kind of monarchical and semi-feudal societies. But anyway, there's one part in that. There's someone whom we come to know of as a culture person is working as a doctor on this, you know, primitive planet, for want of a better way to put it. And she's going out to treat a baby or a child, rather, who is not a baby, actually. It's a young girl who is quite sick. And, you know, you follow the doctor on her journey there, and there's various comments and points being made by Banks as you work through that chapter section. And there's a brutally unsentimental ending to that segment, you know, and it's there's no equivocation, and there's no even hint at a happy ending. And, you know, I could say the ending, I'll try and be as spoiler free as I can, but as you read it, you know what's coming, and it comes. And
yeah, he doesn't let you off the hook.
Exactly. Yeah. And he's absolutely brutal in some ways with that kind of that kind of impact, you know, and there's a reason for that, you know. That's not too shocking.
On that kind of topic, I mean, there's you've listened to enough of Take Me to Your Reader that you know that Colin and I react differently to downer endings, right? And I'm much more on board with a downer ending if I feel like it's earned and we don't just get let off the hook.
Yes.
Yeah. So that we have a happy ending.
Yeah.
And that's, I kind of admire that. If you can set that up and it still works as a good story to me, then I don't mind that you punch me below the belt.
Exactly. And that comes across not just in terms of what I was saying there about, you know, unsentimentality and so forth, but even one of the themes, you know, we'll talk about the culture in a second now, but you know, just to put it very briefly, the culture is this kind of post-scarcity, very prosperous society, and they're dealing with less prosperous societies and possibly interfering with them to bring on their development. And one of the dominant themes of the culture books is that it's almost impossible to do that without the danger of making it worse. And, you know, there's no, these are the good guys, they're going to come in and fix everything and, you know, the effects will take a while to work out. But anyway, it's all for the good. There's none of that. You know what I mean? They have to think really carefully about those plans they have to try and improve the other societies around them. You know, so it's very much, completely, I would say, you used the phrase downer, I would say realistic to be absolutely blunt about it, you know?
But,
it's very much a theme of his work. For someone who's quite witty and funny, you know, you can be reading some pretty strong stuff, you know, and it can be quite depressing. Anyway. So I would regard him as people have different opinions on his writing style. Some enjoy it, some not so much. It's one thing I would say that over the years of reading his books, you know, I bought Consider Phlebas in the 1980s, like literally hot off the presses. And I've been reading him for, well, until he died in 2013, and then rereading him since. And I would say that his style does evolve. It does improve. He does become a lot better, a lot more coherent, a lot more focused. And just his simple prose itself does get better, but it doesn't really change radically. It's very much like his info dumps, for example, when he's giving you all the information on this interstellar society you're looking at, he just tells you the stuff, you know. It's an info dump, but in a very chatty, kind of pleasant kind of way. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's
yeah. I mean, so let's talk about sort of entry level banks, right? And the culture is where to start.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll start with Consider Phlebas. Now, I suppose you could call that a chronological choice. Phlebas is actually it's quite an interesting and distinct culture book, because it is the first one. It's not the first one he actually wrote. Apparently, he wrote a book called Use of Weapons before even he got the Wasp Factory or the Bridge, his mainstream work, his early mainstream work, before he got that published. And Phlebas, I'm quite struck at times by how many people, I should say, when I say people here, because I'm a moderator of the Facebook Science Fiction Book Club group, when I say people's opinions or give you some my assessment of how someone is viewed by the science fiction public, my thinking on that is pretty much dominated by the members of that book club and a few other book clubs or science fiction groups I'm in, you know. I'm in another one, a space opera one, and of course Banks comes up there all the time. So it's striking how even a lot of really hardcore Banks fans who really like his work, his science fiction work, and who really enjoy the culture novels, still, I won't say they disparage Phlebas, but they're just not that enthusiastic about it, because they feel he was very much getting his writing skills down, you know, at the time that it was, you know, his flaws as a writer were on view in that book. And
yeah,
I can see.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that book. And I've always said Phlebas in my head, but I have no idea how it's actually pronounced.
Yeah. I think Scottish people would say Phlebas, so run with that.
All right. Yeah. And then, so can you give us just a quick sort of, you know, what is it, entice people to read it?
Right, sell it, yes. Okay. Now, here's the thing. This book has quite a sort of personal thing for me. One of the reasons I read science fiction, and the only other genre I really read is crime, although not so much anymore. But one of the reasons I read science fiction is because I want a story. I want a plot. I want a tale. Actually, I want a yarn, as in mixed tales, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Phlebas is that in spades. To me, Phlebas it's just a great story. So the plot of Phlebas, let's just talk quickly about that. It's basically this idea of this society, this culture, which is super advanced technology, almost like Clark with that sufficiently advanced technology is like magic. They live not so much on planets, but on these wonderful ideas, these habitats called orbitals, which are essentially huge, like Ringworld from Larry Niven, except much more realistic and much more interesting. And they're very much a, you know, post-scarcity, post-religion in a way, post-capitalism, post all these things.
Post-human in a way too, right?
Exactly, yeah. And this is the thing. One of the dominant set of characters in the culture are these minds with a capital M, which are these super intelligent. You could call them AI, but I'd be reluctant to use that word anymore, because we've kind of seen over the last year or so how crap AI actually is. Yeah. And whereas these are, you know, these are sentient beings, you know, hugely intelligent, vastly intelligent. And they're actually like, I was thinking about this the other day, you know, the opening sequence of The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, where he talks about, I'm going to get this wrong, but vast intelligences, super intelligence is more vast and unsympathetic than our own. That's it.
Right.
Banks's minds are sympathetic. They are empathic. You know, they do like human beings, even though they can be talking to a million different people at the same time, you know, which does actually happen, or we're told it happens in the novels. Anyway, So that's the culture. So the culture are at war in this book, or you're at the beginning of a war between the culture and this other alien species called the Adirans. And they form an empire. It's a theocratic empire, and they are very much planet-based and expansive, aggressive, you know, and they have a very... They're fundamentalist in a religious sense, in the sense that they want to impose their beliefs on other, or convince other alien species or whatever, other civilizations, yeah, of their beliefs. So they're the complete and alternative to the culture. The culture worries and stresses about how to deal with less developed societies. The Adirans just go in and kick ass, as you Americans say, and you know, just take over, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of background to the book. The start of the book is where one of these mines we mentioned is just about to be captured by a Adiran battle fleet or whatever, and it escapes. And what it does is, there's some very clever stuff about subspace or hyperspace or whatever, but it basically slips under the Adiran fleet and gets to a place called Shar's World. Now, This is, again, another one of these very subtle ideas that Banks has, or maybe not so subtle. Shar's World is this place that used to be a humanoid civilization just like our own. And they had these underground command bunkers for fighting a nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And then, unlike us so far, they went ahead and did it about, I think it's meant to be about 11 or 15,000 years before the action of the book. Mm-hmm. So they wiped themselves out and they destroyed their climate and their planet and their biosphere, and pretty much, you know, their entire civilization was annihilated. Now, that happened all that time ago. So what has also happened then is this being called a Drazon. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Drazon, I think, is the correct pronunciation. But it's essentially a relic of a previous species that became so advanced that they, what Banks called, sublimed. And this means that they move on to some, you know, superior level of existence. He's right. Deliberately vague about it.
It reminded me of the kind of evolution of humanity in Childhood's End.
Yeah. Actually, on a personal note as well, actually, no, edit that out. I won't say that. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of Childhood's End. Okay. Anyway, sorry, let me start again.
Yeah.
It's like that idea that Clark had at the end of Childhood's End. Yeah, that humans become this, particularly the notion that all the individual minds merge together in some kind of super overmind kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think Banks' idea of the sublimed is a bit like that. But essentially what happens then is that species or those creatures move out of our plane of existence. They move out of the ordinary business of galactic society. And mm-hmm. So they're the sublimed. And then the species who are left behind are the involved, I think he calls them. Yeah. So there's a distinction there. Now, the Drazon, the being who's in charge of this Shar's World is called Mr. Average, I think they call him, is still slightly involved in regular life in the galaxy at the moment. Anyway, it has preserved this relic of this civilization as a kind of a warning to others. It's called what do they call them? The Worlds of the Dead. I've probably got that phrase wrong. As a sort of exhibition for other species to see.
Right.
This is what will happen.
Don't do this.
Exactly. Yeah. Hold on there, lads. Yeah. And, you know, that's Banks. That's what I mentioned earlier. Banks grew up beside Britain's nuclear deterrent, you know, so that's him. It's kind of an easy way to do it in a way, but, you know, he's presenting that to you. And there's some... I started by saying the writing in Phlebas might not be the best, but there are some wonderful pieces in that book where the characters in this book are walking around this command system, the trains underground and so on, and reflecting on these events, you know, and some of that is great prose, you know what I mean? It's very...
Yeah, I liked that part a lot.
So. Yeah, it was the best part of the book in many ways, you know? Mm-hmm. But anyway...
You haven't mentioned that the point of view character in this book is not someone from the culture, right? He's a changer and essentially sort of a mercenary almost, right? And he's looking for that mind.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to have that POV character not be from the culture, because he's very critical of the culture and their squashing of religions and things.
Yeah.
Not that he's in favor of the other folks,
yeah,
you know, forcing their religion on people, but he feels like the culture is doing the same thing, but with no religion.
Yeah. He's a very interesting character. It's very interesting that Banks's first novel, this is Banks' first novel about the culture that he got published. But you know, as I said earlier, I think he had written Use of Weapons before this, which also has a kind of a peripheral to the culture character. So yeah, I think he wanted to describe it from the outside first.
Yeah.
And then the very next novel, Player of Games, is firmly in the culture. Mm-hmm. And the one that was meant to be the last one, called Look to Windward, same again. It's firmly in the cultural idea. Because this is one of the questions that comes up about Banks and what he's doing here, that it's kind of hard to describe utopia. And it's kind of hard to, you know, have a life that's free of struggle and free of, you know, we'll get back to this again, no doubt, but... You know, I think he wanted to find his feet a lot earlier in order to be able to accept that challenge to try and describe, you know, the interior life of the culture. You know, so he started with people who were outside it and were critical of it, as you said. Yeah. The main character is a chap called, what's his full name? Hora Borza Gobachul. That's the way I would pronounce it anyway.
Mostly just described as Horza, right?
Exactly. Horza is, as the usual. So he is a mercenary, as you said, and he's working for the Durans. And his precise logic, I think, that he says at earlier on in the novel, is that he sees the Durans as being representative of life. And as you said, that the culture is, by making everyone post-scarcity prosperous, and, you know, lacking faith and spirituality and so on, he sees them as anti-life. And of course, in particular, the way that they are dominated by these machines, as he calls them, the AIs, the minds, you know. So, and he sees that as anti-life, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the distinctive thing of Horta and his...
So as we were kind of working up to this episode, we've been planning it for months and months, and I was just, you know, I'll let you know when I get to some of these. And I had picked up the first book, I'm just going to call it Consider Phlebas because that's what it is in my head.
Yeah.
I can't remember, I did listen to the audiobook for this one, and I think that's the way they pronounced it as well. But I bounced off it a little bit. You know, it did not super work for me. There was some interesting stuff in the beginning, and I just sort of trailed off, and my audiobook loan expired. And so, you know, like, okay, I'll get back to that, you know, whenever it comes back through for me. It was weeks and weeks later when it finally came back, and I just went back to the beginning and started over.
Okay.
But then I started in on it again, and I was like, I don't know, this isn't completely working for me.
Right.
And you emailed me that, you know, well, I was kind of wondering if you were just going to skip that one and go to The Player of Games.
Yeah.
And the same day you sent that to me, my audiobook hold for The Player of Games came through. And I was like, you know what, let's do it. And I just ripped through that one. And so let's talk about that novel as well, just because it's another, but more firmly set in the culture with culture POV characters. I have no idea how the book works because I don't think it should work. It's about somebody who plays games. The games are not described in intricate detail, and so you don't really know how he's doing it. And it still is completely enthralling. It's a magic trick.
It's funny you should say that. How does it work and so on? My own opinion on Player of Games. This might be a little bit strong, but let me just say what I want from a science fiction novel and where it takes the boxes. Right, for me, if you have a. Well, by the way, I should say, you know, you are far from being the only. As I think I alluded to this earlier, you're far from the only person. And a lot of people think, you know, the writing's poor, but a lot of people think that Consider Phlebas is overly complicated, like that there are two or three distinct pieces, including the eaters bit, which we'll get back to.
We do need to talk about that.
The shocking bits, exactly.
Yes.
That, you know, they're not necessary. And they kind of have a point, you know, but, you know, Damo likes his plot, so I loved it. But Player of Games, you know, if I classify a science fiction novel, or classify what I want from one, I want good writing. I want, you know, believable, well-written characters. You know, none of this is controversial, I imagine. It shouldn't be too long or too short. It should do what it needs to do reasonably economically, you know. So I'm a real fan of Alistair Reynolds, but I would say, I hope he's not listening to this. I would say that I think a lot of his novels are between 5 and 10% too long. You know, I find myself just saying that over and over again when I think about his books. But anyway, It must, of course, have a plot, a story, a point, and it must have a conceit, a central idea that is science fictional, and that without that idea, the whole thing falls down. You cannot tell this story without those science, that core science fiction concept in it. Mm-hmm. And the player of games hits all those buttons and hits them perfectly well. You know, I just the way it's written, it's actual writing is fantastic. The characters, just even judging from what you say, you tore through it. I reread it in advance of this talk, and I think I read it in 2 or 3 days myself, you know, and it's a long time since I read a book so quickly, you know, it's mm-hmm. so readable. You almost don't notice you're reading, the prose just flows. It's mm-hmm. not particularly literary, although I would argue that in certain points it does kind of soar, you know, there are points where it does become very, you know, you find yourself rereading a piece a few times over, you know, but, you know, and it's, you know, that central idea of the game you mentioned, you know, Banks himself was a big player of games as well. He did like the ideas of strategy and so on, but he also was intrigued by that idea of a game reflecting a society. And then he wanted to use that, you know, and set it in a science fiction context to make it not just reflect a society. So this is the central conceit of the game, that the culture meets this empire called the Empire of Azad, I think it's pronounced, mm-hmm. and they have a game by the same name, and they play this game as a way of establishing who the senior people in government are going to be, the senior tendencies in government, right. political ideas, and so on. Now, it's the other thing about the player games, and the reason I like it so much is that it is pure undistilled Banks. I should say, by the way, Banks was a real, I mentioned how much he loves Scottish culture and society and so on. He was also a very strongly, I'm trying to say that he loved whiskey. I don't mean that in the literal sense that he was an alcoholic. You know, I don't mean it like that. No, what I mean is that he, you know, he loved the culture and the whole idea and the that sense of place inherent in a food product or a drink product, you know, that was bang, you know, that's what Scottish whiskey is all about, you know, and really loved all those ideas, you know. So why did I start talking about whiskey?
I think it was, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea of the game being the society and the culture of not capital C culture, but the culture of this society wrapped up in this game.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and that's, he was a big gamer, and this idea really, really worked for him, you know? So the reason why I say player of games is so fundamentally Banks, what I was actually doing there, and I mentioned whiskey, was because I was saying it's the distillation of Banks. So I was actually, apologize for the pun.
Yeah, here on my soundboard real quick.
Okay, thank you for that. I think I should point out I hate puns, so you know, I say that in sorrow rather than in interest.
All right.
But yeah, there's a complete symbiosis between this game and the society, as we were saying there. So the plot of the book is quite straightforward in a way, that this chap, Jernau Gourgay, I think that's how you pronounce it, mm-hmm. he is a culture citizen. So as you said earlier, this is the novel where we get to see this guy's life in the culture. You know, he's a player of games, right? As the title suggests, he's a game player. So for someone who's I think you can call him a citizen of the culture, although apparently there's no real concept of formal citizenship. But because of their society, he literally does nothing else. He's like, I could say I'm a lecturer in maths. He could say mm-hmm. I'm a game player. You know, he does nothing else. Now, he does it a lot. He analyzes games. He writes papers, academic papers on games and so on. But you know, he's not employed by some university or anything like that to mm-hmm. make his way. You know, in a post-scarcity society, you can do what you want.
Right. But in this case, he is approached by contact, which is the subsection of the culture that interacts with other cultures. And I keep saying cultures and it's getting confusing.
I know what you mean, yeah.
But, you know, essentially to almost be an ambassador through his games, or, you know, maybe not ambassador, more like espionage, but it turns out to be more of the latter.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know it. So.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a great sort of resonance, I suppose, between the different layers that Banks alleged were, might have been there. He's been sent there to play a game, and the culture contact section, as you said, are doing this just as a way to connect, apparently, with the Azadian ruling classes. But in reality, there's another game going on beneath all that.
Right.
And Gurgay himself is just a pawn in that game.
Yeah.
And in fact, and again, now this is where that theme throughout, I should say that's the Dublin accent showing there. When I say theme, I mean theme, not team.
I understood you.
Yeah. When I lived in Scotland, they used to tell me that people used to ask me, did I have a speech impediment? You know, I was like, no, buddy, it's just a Dublin accent. Anyway, so he's sent there to play this game and, you know, as a way of analysing Azadian society for the culture. But yes, there's a game going on. And it's that concept of how does the culture deal with a society? The Azadian Empire, the Azadian society is an appallingly, you know, brutal society. It is based around privilege, possession. It's Gurgay himself as he works his way through that society. And the interesting thing to me is that the culture is the imaginative bit. Azad is not, or Azadian society is not imaginative at all. It is our type of society. You know?
Yes.
Kingship, monarchy, and so on, and the brutality that goes on with that. And of course, they're a very imperialistic society. So the culture are trying to decide what to do about this, just the misery of everyday Azadian life. So they send him to play the game. And as we've been saying, the game they're playing underneath that is that they are going to bring about the downfall of the Azadian Empire itself, and they're going to come up afterwards and mop up the bits and try and make the best of it. Yeah. And it's an early novel, so he had more subtle ideas about this kind of stuff later on. But I think his point here was that kind of brutal society, there's almost nothing else he can do. You know, you may as well suck up the damage you're going to do, and you may as well just go in and with your boots and kick in the door, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a hugely interesting book in that sense, presenting that dilemma that the culture finds itself in.
Yeah.
And the strength of the book really comes from when the character of Gurgay is in Azad and he sees it, he sort of thinks, yeah, this is bad, but, you know, I mean, yeah, it's an economic system. Maybe we could tweak it and fix it and gradually evolve, blah, blah, blah. But he's accompanied by... We were talking earlier about how the AIs in the culture are sentient beings, which, you know, they're people, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not just the minds with a capital M, it's the drones as well, which are more like human beings in the sense that they're at our kind of level of, you know, they can't talk to more than 3 or 4 people at a time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So this drone that accompanies him to, Azad. Now, there's a very funny, just a slight aside here, there's a very funny part of the book to me is the way this drone must pretend to be a lot less sophisticated technology than it actually is to fool the Azadians. Yeah. So there's all this kind of stuff that it has
to... Well, it's part of the unreliable narrator too that you were talking about before.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so this drone must disguise itself as a piece of junk, basically, with a little hissing and crackling and so forth. But anyway...
I pictured it like the little boxy droid that walks around... like the Gonk droid, is what I pictured, but floating from Star Wars. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So the drone takes him out one night. The drone has been telling Gurgay, they're not getting on very well, and it's been telling Gurgay that it's just been going out monitoring birds and bird life and animal life and so forth on the planet. But what it's actually doing is looking at the underbelly of Azadian society.
Yeah.
And, you know, how can I put this? To me... You know, I live in Dublin. It's a nice city, mostly. It's an expensive city in case anyone's thinking of coming here, but anyway. And it has, you know, it's prosperous areas and less affluent areas. And of course, we're a capitalist Western country.
Right.
So there are a lot of poor people here, you know. So even though Ireland is one of the richest countries in the world by the overall GDP and all those other measures, you know, we have a downside, you know, very much have a downside. We have a terrible homelessness problem here in Dublin. So it's like any city like that. It's like New York, Paris, London, Berlin, whatever. And Gurgay is taken out and shown the downside. And in particular, he's shown how he can't just march into some situation he sees and try and fix it. That not just the fact that he's an alien, but apparently he, like a lot of culture, people we learn are brown skinned, and the Azadians are very white. and they have, are very pale anyway. I don't know if you'd call them white, but he's told they have bred themselves to be paler because this is good. And if he reaches out with his brown hand, he will be immediately attacked. You know, so it's a profoundly racist society, you know. So Banks is throwing all this kind of stuff at us, and he's making us think, you know, again, Azad is just a mirror to our own society, you know. Now, it's presented as being particularly brutal, you know. I don't want to sound like some naive liberal who's saying, oh, it's not that bad here. You know, it is.
Right.
You know, in certain places, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, society's here with extremes of wealth and poverty, you know. So, yeah, he's shown all this. And some of this stuff is beautifully written. Like, I think those parts were difficult to read, that section where the drone shows Gourgay the reality of society.
Yeah.
They were kind of difficult to read, but they I read them really quickly because they're so compelling and so wonderfully and plainly written, you know. And they show what Banks is trying to say about privilege and power and corruption and all these kind of critiques of our own societies, you know, and he's doing that, and he, you know, we do not get away with it. You know, we cannot look away, and Gourgay cannot look away, you know. And it has a profound effect on the character of Gourgay. And then just, you know, in terms of the plot of the novel, as we've been saying, he has to play these games to interact with the Azadian ruling classes. But what he realizes after all this is that he's playing the game. Now, as you said, it is the case. We don't really know too much about the details of the game. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not chess. It's apparently incredibly complex. That was the impression.
Yeah, it keeps talking about how, you know, he may lose this round, but he set himself up next for the Board of Becoming, you know, or these other things. And you start to get used to the kind of rhythm of it, but you don't really understand the game mechanics.
No. And actually, it's a tribute to Banks' writing that you're swept up in his gameplay, but you've actually no idea how he's actually playing the game. But what he realizes, what Gourgay realizes, is that he's playing as a culture citizen. So he marshals all his pieces, he protects them and so forth, whereas the Azadians will throw pieces into a fight or, you know, some piece of combat on the game with no concern for the pieces themselves. And so then Gourgay's struggle about the nature of these societies comes back, you know. It's a way in which the player of games, I know I talk about how direct and straightforward Banks is, but the player of games is actually quite a sophisticated novel in that way. Like, the very idea of using a society dependent on a game, on a very complicated game, it's quite subtle, you know. There's a lot to it, you know. I know I've been saying all along that he has these political positions and you will know them unequivocally when you're finished the book. But, you know, it's not brutally simple, you know. It's not simplistic, you know. That's the best way to put it, I think. But, fantastic book, though.
And there's some great science fiction in there, too, just about I mentioned that it's post-human, not just in that there's mines and drones, but that all the apparently human people are also quite engineered, right? They're I don't know if they're immortal, but they're very long-lived. And then they have the ability to, you know, they drink something, oh, that might be poison, and it just gets shunted off and not metabolized. Or there's a point in the novel where he's, you know, the venue for the game changes to different moons and different places in the Azadian system. And there's one that's much higher gravity. Well, his physiology is able to change. And so his, you know, he becomes a little thicker and able to deal with the gravity, you know, over the course of being there. And that was really a fun idea.
And again, Banks is using that because if you remember after that very thing you're talking about now, I've actually, in my notes, I haven't remembered the name of that moon because some very significant events happen there at the end of the book. It's essentially, it's where the emperor is crowned. And the games reached our climax on this moon.
Right, because there's this huge conflagration that comes in. You have to finish the game before then.
Fantastic, so he, they go there because of all this. And as you said, it's a higher gravity moon. And Gourgay, as you said, quickly adapts, unlike the rest of the Azadian court. And a few of the members there, you can hear the whirring of their exoskeletons as they come and go from dinner and all this kind of stuff, you know. But Gourgay has to actually ask the drone, you know, I seem to be getting used to this, you know, I'm doing well, I'm okay now, you know. And the drone tells him in no uncertain terms, you know, you were taking your, there's a phrase, genofixing, I think is for those modifications you were talking about there. The drone tells him you were taking that for granted, just like you were taking almost everything else in culture society for granted. Like, and it's another echo of when someone had to explain to Gourgay what ownership was. And we're told at the very start of the novel that Gourgay himself is slightly at odds with cultural society, in the sense that he lives in a particular house, and when he goes away, other people have been living there and have changed things slightly, and he resents that, and that's not the culture way. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't mm-hmm. own that house. You know, no one else owns it either, you know, but and Gourgay is an odd kind of fella in the sense that he feels a tinge of ownership, but yet still he has to have that sort of, you know, brutal version of ownership in Azad explained to him. Yeah. And even has to have his own body modifications explained to him, you know. And again, referring to Banks' love of whiskey, there is a character in it who cultural people could drink alcohol and then they can metabolize out, as you said, yeah. the alcohol in the drink, you know, and not get drunk. But mm-hmm. there's one guy who he's a previous ambassador, so to speak. And I think actually, no, sorry, he's the actual ambassador of the culture to the Azadian court. Yeah. And he has had all his glands and genofixing undone. So he compensates for that for himself by getting drunk, which he would not be able to do if he was, or could choose not to do if he was still a cultural citizen.
Yeah. I mean, they're very different two books here. And I do want to at least briefly touch on the use of weapons. That's another one. It's one that I haven't read, so I want to, you know, you can just try and convince me to read it. But I think you did want to go back to talk about some of the shocking bits, like
So one of the key things about Player of Games is that in some ways it's a response to Consider Phlebas, as we've said, that it's inside the culture now and so on. But so it's kind of going back to Phlebas will introduce us in a good way to the shocking bits. Almost every book by Banks, I'm reading, or I just recently finished Look to Windward, and I think that might be the exception in the sense that it's not particularly strongly shocking bits, but almost every other book by him has some piece or some element that really shocks you, that is really, like we're going to talk about the Eaters section of Consider Phlebas. A lot of people, when you're reading their reviews or their comments about this book, they are people I've lent the book to, you know, come back to me and say, why did you give me this book with this appalling stuff in it, you know? Yeah, getting back to Phlebas, basically this section that I'm talking about is a part where in the plot of Consider Phlebas, there's a part where there's an orbital, Vavach is the name of it, that our main character, Horta, ends up on this orbital, and he ends up within the orbital, he ends up marooned on this small island, and the orbital is going to be destroyed by the culture, because the Adirans are occupying that volume of space mm-hmm. and they wouldn't accept a deal from the culture to regard it as neutral territory. So they're going to occupy it. So the culture says, well, look, we're going to destroy it then. And, you know, this is the background to what's going on. And it's interesting you mentioned at the conclusion of Player of Games, they have to finish these games because, as you said, that firestorm is coming to the castle where they're playing their games.
Right.
Consider Phlebas has a similar idea that there are games and card games and so forth going on this orbital called Vavach before the culture destroys it.
You know? Damage,
so it's a very interesting team. Yeah. Exactly, the damage game, which is an interesting one. Now, that's one of those pieces that people say you could probably take out of the book and not lose a lot, which is, you know, possibly.
I don't know, the idea of wagering people's lives is,
that was
compelling.
But anyway, so Horta gets himself marooned on this island, and on the island there is a cult of people who they're called the Eaters, and, you know, get that blooper thing ready, because they literally live on a diet of shit, and they're being fed this by their cult leader, and so obviously they're effectively dying of malnutrition, and they have forsworn any attempt to leave the island or the orbital, because they're convinced by their cult leader not to do that. And it's one of those points where you have this situation where a society based on rationality and reason and tolerance has to deal with the intolerant and the irrational. And how are you going to do that? So what happens there is that the culture leaves a shuttle on the island, and, you know, so that these Eater cult people can board the shuttle as the destruction of Avach comes on. And the culture shuttle, I think it has a countdown clock, so they can see just how long they have before they need to get out of Dodge, before the destruction. And they don't, you know, their critical faculties, their reason has been impaired by this terrible diet they're eating. They actually catch fish from the sea. And as far as I remember, they cut up the fish and they eat the guts and they throw away the actual meat.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout all this, of course, when Gurge has been captured by them, he's starving, you know, he's really hungry. And because he goes through his changing process, he's a changer, so he can change his face and appearance and so forth. And even, I think, to a certain extent, his species. So because he has just gone through that, he's especially starving. You know, he needs nutrition to make up for that that work he's been doing internally. So he keeps looking at all these bits of fish being cooked and thrown away, you know, and it's, you know, I actually feel hungry now just reminiscing about this this part of the book. Mind you, there are those who would say I'm always hungry, but anyway. So, you know, these guys are, as I said, literally eating, you know, what you should not be eating. Mm-hmm. And they're starving to death, they're malnourished, so they're not in any position to escape, whereas their cult leader, and this is something that Banks has been criticized about, is, you know, enormous. He's very, very large because he is eating all these things. Now, I've described that. That sounds terrible. It sounds disgusting. But there's one even worse piece to that, you know, where basically this cult leader chap eats Gurge's finger. And, right. You know, he goes into
it's
that.
It's really gross.
It is. It goes into it in unsparing detail, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that one, I think, is the epitome of the shocking elements that are in almost every single Banks book. One of my favorite articles about that appeared around the time that Banks announced that he was, you know, diagnosed with terminal cancer is a chap called Patrick Frayne, who writes for the Irish Times newspaper here in Dublin. And he wrote, if you can find it, it's a really wonderful piece. But what he did was, and I was not aware of this when I read this in back then, he referred to the Irish Times initial review of Banks's first book called The Wasp Factory. And they called it, the exact quote is, they called it a work of unparalleled depravity.
Mm.
And you know, and it's not as bad. Well, there is one thing in The Wasp Factory that's pretty disgusting, pretty, if I can use your word there, pretty gross. But it's still, you know, The Eaters is right up there, you know. It's genuinely disgusting. It's not an easy read, you know. And especially for someone like myself, if you're rereading it and you know it's coming, you know. I will admit there have been one or two times, I've read that book about 10 times, and there have been occasions when I've said, do you know what, this time I'll just give it a miss, you know,
and yeah,
hop on to the next bit, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the shocking bits, you know.
Yeah. So just really briefly, you mentioned that the use of weapons is another one that's more closely, like, from inside the culture, right?
Yeah. Well, use of weapons has some parts that are within the culture, but it is, again, another one that's mostly about a guy who's on the periphery. It's about a character called Zakalbe, and he's not a culture person. And actually, use of weapons is another book with an appalling, shocking moment in it, which I absolutely won't, you know, maximum spoiler avoidance here. I am
sure.
Not going to. Actually, that's a good name. I should have said something there earlier on. One of the funniest things about Banks's books about the culture is that the spaceships, the so-called general systems vehicles, or even any of the smaller ones, they all have these witty names.
Yes.
Just what I said there, actually, maximum avoidance of spoilers. That would be a good...
That does sound like one of the ship names.
I'm delighted with that now.
The Clear Air Turbulence, yes.
Oh, yeah, the Clear Air Turbulence, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And the... you know, you could imagine a spacecraft named after your what your mother says to you, you know, don't let me come down to you. You know, I think there's right. one just like that, you know, somewhere. But yeah, it's a dominant feature. And there's a book called Accession, which is the plot line there is dominated by culture mines and the spaceships, you know, the general systems vehicles. Mm-hmm. And there's an endless list of names of these spacecraft, you know, and they're all extremely witty. But what I would say as well is some of them are very Scottish. They're things that only Scottish people would say or you know, that style of wit anyway, you know. So I should have mentioned that earlier on. But anyway, yeah, sorry, we were talking about use of weapons. Yeah, Zakalbe is outside the culture and he's recruited as a mercenary for them. So he does, and he's a perfect example of an attempt to fix a less developed society that is, you know, brutal and, you know, as we were talking about the Azadian Empire and so on. Mm-hmm. And he tries to do some of that stuff himself. He goes rogue, so to speak, and he tries to do that himself and makes a Hames of it. And so there's a culture agent who is his contact, let's call it, has to go chasing after him. And they can't really undo the damage he does. But what they can do is stop him doing any more, you know. Mm. And I think when you said I was talking about a book written in the culture, I think you might have been talking about Look to Windward.
Yeah, I think I got that mixed up.
The Look to Windward, the title of that book, it is kind of related to Consider Phlebas, and it's kind of a more direct sequel to that. Player of Games is kind of a, you might call it a response to Consider Phlebas, but Look to Windward is a almost a direct sequel, yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about that one, or?
Let's pass it over and just say that, sure. You know, that's another recommendation for Saturday. Yeah. We're still in sort of entry-level banks, and we do need to move on at some point.
Yeah,
Episode's going to get too long.
Yeah, so Look to Windward, it is, as I said, a sequel to Phlebas, and in a very direct way, in the sense that this book is very much about the aftermath of conflicts. So I mentioned the culture Edirian war that was in the main action, I suppose, of Consider Phlebas. So what you're going to see in this book is, and if I can take the approach you mentioned earlier of just trying to sell it to people to give it a read, it is, I would call it kind of intermediate banks in the sense that it is quite a sophisticated book like Player of Games, but all of his science fiction, I would say, is very accessible. You know, it is very, this one's very readable. It's another one that I read, like Player Games, in about 2 or 3 days, you know. It's essentially set a few hundred years after the Culture Edirian War. Now, again, it addresses that theme of the culture meddling in other civilizations' development and so on. So it's a kind of a retort or maybe a sympathetic view of what Bora Herzog-Obichul was saying in Consider Phlebas. He, one of his critiques of the culture, aside from what we were saying about spirituality and life and so forth, he disliked their smugness and their arrogance and their meddling, you know?
Yeah.
And this is kind of pursuing that theme, you know? So basically there's this other civilization called the Chelgrians, and they're not humanoid quite, but they're a reasonably advanced civilization, and they suffered this devastating civil war. They called it the caste war because theirs was a society that was based around, you know, power, privilege, hierarchical systems, an outright caste system. Mm. And, you know, they had a war about that. The people at the bottom, you know, rebelled and, you know, that's how it went. So, and particularly the Chelgrians kind of wrap all this up with tradition. You know, and it's a very much Banks looking at the idea of tradition being an excuse that we should leave things the way they are. You know, he's pushing back against that. But you have a lot of characters. The main character, one of the main characters in this book is a Chelgrian who fought in that war. And in that way, we've seen a few examples of characters who are on the bad side but are sympathetic. You know, they're complex in that regard. Mm. Our main guy, one of our main guys here is a soldier who fought on that caste side war on the wrong side, but he lost his wife in that war. So it's, a lot of it is about his grief and, you know, his loss. And it's also about the fact that he doesn't want to make up that loss in any kind of way. What he wants is to die. You know, you get that impression straight away from the start of the book. He wants oblivion. And like we talked about the sublime and the idea of that earlier on, a lot of Banks' civilizations have these kind of ideas that you can, in a kind of virtual reality sense, create an artificial heaven, or indeed hell in one of the books. And the Chelgrians have done this, but his wife, Quillen is the name of this character, his wife was not uploaded into this heaven place. Mm. So he doesn't want either. He wants true death in the sense that we understand it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oblivion, as I said there. I will say Windward, it's a great book in many ways, in the sense that it has that plot that Damo just loves, you know what I mean? There's a very like Player of Games, there's a plot going on. Because the culture meddled in the affairs of the Chelgrians and kind of started the war. Now, the war is over several years at the time of the book, and what's happened is they are trying to reach out to a Chelgrian composer, a chap called Ziller, who lives on a particular culture orbital Mazdak, and they send Quillen to try and persuade him to move back. That's the surface story. But what's actually going on is this is a suicide mission, and Quillen is going to, he's going to commit a dreadful act and take revenge for the meddling. Mm. And it's one of these, we mentioned unreliable narrators, it's one of these books where the main character, Quillen, in order to sneak into the culture orbital, he has had his memory of his mission erased. But then he gradually reacquires those memories as we work our way through the plot. And of course, you know, we then learn about his whole process of being brought in to whatever faction of the Chaldreans is doing this. But there's also a question, they're getting outside help from some other civilization. And there's a question about who's actually helping them. And it might actually be, there's a speculation that it's a group of culture minds who think their society has become soft. And that conflict was coming with the Chaldreans, so they had to they have to prepare the culture for that with a dramatic event, you know, something really awful, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of plot of the book, you know. And you know, that just sounds like an exciting science fiction novel, but there's a load of stuff in this book about grief, about loss, about just the business of processing grief. There's a wonderful piece in it where the target of his mission seems to be the culture mind that runs this Mazdak orbital. But you find out that the mind that's running this orbital used to be a general systems vehicle in the Kultur-Edirian War. And it was one of the GSVs that destroyed some culture orbitals to prevent them from, you know, falling into the Edirian hands and so on. And this led to the death of, I think it was millions, but it might have been more. But there's a wonderful piece where this mind tells you about how it's in touch with human minds and other culture minds as they die. And that it says it feels remorse over these deaths, but it's not just, you know, the way a human being might feel remorse over causing a death, but this mind was right there when these creatures died and recorded their, you know, their horror, their fear, their loneliness, and so on, you know. So if I was to sell this book on one aspect, it would be that piece where the mind, it turns out, wants oblivion as well for the same reason. Now, when I say that, though, the other side of this book is some of it is laugh out loud funny. The character of Ziller, the Chaldrian who lives in the orbit, in the culture orbital, you know, you see some of the activities. It is, as we started saying, it's told, most of it is told from within the culture. And you see the activities people get up to. And they do this one sport called lava rafting, where you take this super duper culture technology raft and you paddle down, you know, the output of a volcano, you know, magma and lava. And it's hilarious. The dialogue between them is just absolutely outrageously funny. You know, it's full of real dry wit, but also full of devastatingly, fantastically written stuff about the whole subject of grief and loss and what have you, and revenge.
So any other, how much did we talk about the mainstream stuff?
We haven't really talked about it at all. I mentioned Whit briefly. That's the one, I was talking about that, where it's about this young woman who lives in a religious community in Scotland. And I've kind of described it in my notes as a reverse science fiction story. So she comes out of a very narrow, they live on a very small island, so it's a very prescribed existence. And then she goes into mainstream life in Britain. And it's another one of Banks' analyses of belief and cults and so on, but it's much more sympathetic. And as I might have said earlier on, it talks about the value of community and so forth, that the people in such a religious community. Yeah, so it kind of treats, I suppose, late 20th century Britain as a kind of alien society and, you know, through her eyes, you know. So it's a wonderfully written book and it's extremely funny as well. It's one where, you know, it's just Banks writing a regular novel. And it's laugh out loud funny in parts, you know, and particularly when she comes up against the police, you know, and she's dealing with them as a sensible young lady. And they're saying, you know, get into the back of the van, you know.
Right, right. So would you say, why would somebody who has come to Banks through his science fiction, why would they, you know, entertain the idea of reading the mainstream stuff? Not, of course, that nerds don't like to read anything that's not science fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it just because the commonalities of his style?
Yeah, it's the commonality of style, theme, the sort of, there's always a plot. You know, you always have, a lot of his books are, I think the technical term is a Bildungsroman. You know, you have someone who learns something about either themselves or the society around them and is transformed by that knowledge. You know, a lot of his science fiction is like that. But his mainstream work is very definitely along those lines. That woman with, she learned something about that religious society she came from. You know, it won't be a spoiler to say that it's a fraud. You know, it's all based on a lie. But she also learns, as we were saying there, about the value of community and so forth, you know, and learns something about, I suppose, genuine spirituality. You know, she doesn't shed that part of her life at all. You know, she remains to be a spiritual person. So a lot of the Wasp Factory is very much like that. His very controversial first published novel, like the lead character, Frank, learns something about themselves. And reading the Wasp Factory, it's very much, as I said to you, it is a mainstream novel. There's nothing science fictional in there, but it's tremendously weird. And you learn a lot again about, you know, this one is particularly about gender roles, I suppose, and also about critiques of magic and irrationality. And you know, if you're someone who does the horoscope, I wouldn't necessarily recommend the Wasp Factory. It's a devastating critique of that. But yeah, except for the science fiction elements, it's almost identical to any of his other books. The writing style, the themes, the ideas, the analyses, the critique of our society, the critique of power of you know, patriarchal societies and so on. His mainstream work barely differs from his science fiction in that regard. You know, it's very much very very similar. Yeah,
nice. And you know, just for notes for listeners, I have a pretty extensive number of recommendations from Damo on further reading. And so if we don't mention some of these novels and you see them in the show notes, then consider them recommended by Damo.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I can't emphasize enough how much of a fan I am. You know, it's from that kind of practical point of view that I read science fiction because I like a plot and I like analysis that can only be done by fantastical literature. Yeah. Banks is the epitome of that. I would suggest one last book that we should comment on. Sure. And we'll call this Advanced Banks, just to sort of follow the format to its natural conclusion. Mm-hmm. And that's The Bridge. And The Bridge is actually the very first book I read by Banks. I read it before Consider Phlebas, which was my first science fiction book. It's an interesting one because it is, strictly speaking, a mainstream novel. You can explain everything that happens in this book by it being the dreams of someone who's been in a car crash, you know, and their attempt to come back to their life. So in that sense, it's a mainstream novel, you know, but it is very science fictional. The society he lives in while he's in this kind of dream state, there's three strands to the book. So there's the real world, the coma character's new life on this strange kind of society that is quite literally built around a bridge. And then there's this other strand in there where you've got this barbarian character who wonderfully speaks in this Scottish accent, this really strong Scottish accent, which is, I won't say it's difficult to read, but it's you know, it takes a bit of work, you know, and I got the hang of it before I went there, and that meant that being there I was able to understand people a lot better, you know. But there's very interesting stuff in the Bridge about, which kind of reflects Banks' own life and reflects my life as well, that he was from a working, that the character in the novel is from a working class background. So as a child, his father works on steam locomotives, you know, steam engines included. Mm-hmm. And he sees this and, but then he grows up to become an engineer and becomes quite affluent, you know, and he regards himself as a socialist and a lefty and he votes for Labour. But yet Margaret Thatcher's decisions in British life make things very easy for him in terms of, you know, keeping that affluence that he has earned, you know.
Right.
So, and the accent bit reflects that, like the talk about, I actually mentioned this, I think, near the start of the podcast, just the way that, you know, if you're from a working class area, you'll have quite a strong local accent. And then as you become more affluent and as you move around and meet people, as you were saying there, about from all over the world in your job or whatever,
right,
you find yourself speaking more clearly or whatever, you drop.
Right, code switching. Yeah.
Exactly, code switching. That's exactly the phrase that I was talking to try and remember. which is a beautiful book about that kind of stuff. You know, there's a lot of subtleties to the book that it's by far his most complex book. And he himself said, ironically for me, he himself said, don't start with the bridge. You know, leave that till you're well used to my work. And of course, naturally, I had to, I'd never heard of him before that. Yeah. So, but if you do read The Bridge, it would bring you to everything else he did, you know.
Yeah.
There's also, I should say again, content warning, there's one of those shocking scenes in The Bridge, if you get to read it, towards the end. I'm just going to say there's a bit about a pig and a rifle, and I'm not going to say any more. You know, I'm absolutely not going to say any more about that. But, you know, again, the wit of Banks, particularly his Scottish wit, is there in spades, you know what I mean? The Bridge epitomises that. I know I've said this, that, or the other novel already epitomises Banks, but, you know, the Bridge epitomises it yet again, you know, so...
Nice.
I strongly recommend it, you know.
And then he does have some non-culture science fiction as well.
He does, yeah. Now, one of those books, now, if we are talking about advanced Banks and Scottish accents and stuff written to capture that accent, his most advanced book, in my own opinion, is a book called Fearsome Engine. Now, even the way the title of that book is written, it's written as if you're a Scottish person saying it, you know. So you can read it and go, well, no, I'm sure I was nearly going to try and attempt a Scottish accent, but I am not going to do that. someone will track me down. Yeah, it's a really, again, it's a book with three or four strands. Almost every book he writes, actually, when I think of it, has at least two, if not three or four strands of the tale, you know. I'd almost call it difficult, you know. I'm almost reluctant to say that because you can read it and you're still reading, except for one stream, which is entirely written in a Scots dialect. And you can see Scottish people debating about whether it's actually Scots or just a Scottish accent. But it is still, you know, for someone like you or me, who is not Scottish, it does represent a bit of a challenge. I read The Bridge, I found that okay. So I was fine when I moved to Scotland, but I only understood Fearsome Engine after living there for a few years. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
It was an invaluable assistance to me to actually emigrate there. Now I'm not, well, I would almost suggest it's such a good book, and Scotland is a nice place for someone to emigrate there just to get the grips of that book. But it is challenging, you know, it is the advanced Banks, you know. But just to get back to what you said then, the other one of the most prominent non-culture science fiction novels he has is The Algebraist, which is, it's not dissimilar to a culture novel, but it, again, the same concepts, the same structures, the same idea of three or four different strands, very subtle complexities in the plot, you know. It's, I actually haven't read it myself for a few years, and I would be hard pressed to, I could tell you the start of all the plot strands, but I would be reluctant to say how they, you know, conclude, you know, how they are resolved, because I might get it wrong. Do you know what I mean? So it is definitely a complex novel, but very rewarding. It's wonderfully written, just like most of his later books, you know, when he really got his craft nailed down.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to probably leave it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really appreciate you doing this. I think originally we were talking about just doing an episode on Consider Philebus, and I think we sort of did a mini episode.
I think it was good. It was your suggestion to fold in the discussion about Philebus into this thing, and I think that was a good idea.
Yeah. Just once you started letting me know how much of a fan you were, I thought, well, yeah. And yes, you did graciously offer. I'll step aside if there's a Scottish listener, a Scottish expert.
Yeah, that was very important. I'm glad that has come out in the wash.
Yes.
Yeah. I will say one thing before we wrap it up. There's one book of his that I would also recommend people read. It's called Raw Spirit, and it's a book where he tours around Scotland looking at, obviously tasting the products of the various distilleries, whiskey distilleries in Scotland. And it's a very interesting book, because not just if you like whiskey, but actually your friend on the Hugh Goes There podcast is a whiskey drinker, isn't he?
Take Me to Your Reader, yeah, James.
Oh, sorry, Take Me to Your Reader, yeah. The chap who served in the Navy, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd recommend it for him in particular, but it's also a great insight into Banks' life and his, you know, the kind of person he is. And it's also hilariously funny in parts. Like, it's really, really interesting. The one downside is that he has fairly scabrous and ill-informed opinions about Irish and American whiskies. and I, you know, I'm obviously sad that the chap died in 2013, but if he was alive today, we're living through a golden age of Irish whiskey. Mm. We're leaving the Scots in the dust. And they won't even admit that we invented it, you know? So, you know, the poor man, I wish he was still alive anyway to be writing books, but I wish he was still alive to come and visit, you know, the likes of this, that, or the other distillery I could name in Dublin, you know? So well, I recommend that book. It's very entertaining.
Nice, nice. I'll definitely recommend it to James. And James will be in Glasgow as well.
Oh,
so,
right.
Okay. So we can sit down and you guys can nerd out about whiskey.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And possibly, hopefully not drink too much of it as well, you know.
That would be knowing important. James, I'm not sure that that's in the cards, but we'll see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. All right. Any social media presence you want to talk about before we sign off?
Yeah, I don't. I'm not a big social media person. Now, anyone who knows me might laugh at that, but I'm only on Facebook. I joined it very, very late. And then the first thing I did was just join a clatter of science fiction groups. But that got so bad that I am now one of the moderators of the Science Fiction Book Club. So that's the only place you'll find me, either Facebook, Damon O'Quillig, or in the Science Fiction Book Club itself. If you apply for membership, then there's a 1 in 4 chance that the person who's seen, did you actually give the name of an actual science fiction writer and not J.R. Tolkien, is me. So that's the only place you'll find me. You know, so.
Excellent. And I see you popping up in comments on other podcasts and that kind of stuff. And I always wonder with that, like, did you come to them through me? Did you come to me through them? Well, you know, where did the trace start?
That's a good question. I actually can't remember. I think I came to the Hugo Girls first, but as soon as I started listening to them, they mentioned you. So then I think I found you immediately. But then it was a while afterwards before I started listening to other podcasts, like, you know, like Phil's Science Fiction 101, Phil and Colin, and his Bradbury podcasts, which are, I'm really enjoying them. You know, I haven't read Bradbury for a while, and Phil single-handedly brought me back into the fold, you know.
Yeah, he did the same for me. So I hadn't really read much of him at all, just since, you know, mandatory reading in high school. But all right, well, Damo, thanks again for doing this. I really appreciate your flexibility. We've been kicking this around for months and finally got it done.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm delighted to, what was that cliche? Long-time listener, first-time caller, you know?
So exactly.
I'm glad to call in, you know? It's great. Like, I hope I communicated at least something of the reasons why Banks, you know, means so much to me, you know? And I hope I haven't put anyone off, actually.
All right. Thanks, Damo.
Good luck.
All right. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Damo. We've been kicking this around for quite a few months trying to get this arranged and just kind of waiting on my schedule to be able to get to it. So really appreciate Damo for being patient with me. I think I mentioned on this podcast that I'm planning to be at Glasgow Worldcon. We have our tickets. We have our accommodation. So we will be there. I'm not sure exactly which days we'll be there. I know we'll be there for the Hugo ceremony. So I would love to meet any listeners out there who want to meet up and say hi. That'd be great. So if you're going to be there, reach out to me and we'll figure out a way to say hello. As usual, you know, the normal places, if you want to support the podcast, you can buy me a coffee, look in the show notes for the link. You can support me on Patreon, look in the show notes for the link for that as well. Or just, you know, do the normal social media sharing of the podcast. And I think that'll about do it for this time. So thank you so much for listening and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.